Welcome to our spring season live from the New York Public Library opening night. My name is Paul Holdengraber. I am the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library. I could think of no better way of opening this season than with the evening you're about to experience. Remix, making art and commerce thrive in the hybrid economy. It's hip, it's cool, it's provocative. It's another evening co-presented and co-sponsored with Wired magazine. We've had fun with Wired, especially with Melanie Cornwell, who I love, who has been the originator, yes, for Melanie, who has been the originator of much of this mischief. Thank you so much, Melanie. Be it back in my blessed days in Los Angeles, when David Byrne gave a PowerPoint presentation entitled I Love Heart PowerPoint, or Wilco's Jeff Tweedy together with Stephen Johnson and Lawrence Lessig talking about who owns culture, and of course our big event on Google. But enough about the past. Here's the future, especially if, as the French poet Paul Valéry once said, the future isn't what it used to be. Well, here it is, a language I barely understand, but know is important, of mashup and remix. Here is our dream team, Lawrence Lessig, back for the fourth time here live from the New York Public Library, Stephen Johnson, joined by Shepard Fairey, who recently has been, I think, somewhat in the press. But before getting to the presentations and the conversations and the questions, let me tell you something about upcoming live programs and something about this evening. First of all, please, please consider becoming a friend of the library. Starting for as little as $40, you are in. You're a friend, and that gets you a $15 ticket to all live events instead of $25. That's a $10 off each and every time. There's a membership table. Go to it after the event, and please join tonight. It will help our cause tremendously. What is our cause, you may ask? To bring you live conversations, discussions, debates, to present you with what I like to call cognitive theater. And what's coming up? Next week, we have the president of the New York Public Library, Paul Leclerc. He will be in conversation with Father Patrick Desbois. We will then host a tribute to John Updike with David Remnick, ZZ Packer, Sonny Mehta, and many others. Shortly after that, Thomas Friedman with Nandan Nilekani, Andrei Codrescu will interview Henry Alford and Mark Twain. This will be my first impersonification of Mark Twain. A two-part series this spring with Book Forum entitled Cultural Obituaries. A two-part evening with Alex Ross, Barbara Eisenberg, and Frank Gehry, followed by Alex Ross interviewing the composer and conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen, and much, much more. Join our email list, but also, and here's something brand new and exciting, which started last night, join our blog at www.nypl.org/blog instead of /live. Ask questions of the talent before the event and after. Abi Warburg once spoke of the afterlife of the work of art. Now the time has come for the afterlife of the conversations or debates. Voice your interest, your agreement, your dissent. When we get your Q&A, we got three Q&A questions tonight, which we will pose after the event. You may also submit questions tonight in writing before you leave at the end of the evening and at our feedback station or online. Stephen Johnson, who is the 35th most popular man on Twitter, will... I don't even know what I'm saying, but I know... I found out about Twitter 2 weeks ago, but I'm just not a son of modernity, but I know all of this is terribly important, will serve as master of ceremonies, instigator and moderator, and much more. He will tell us how the evening will unfold, what the issues are, but the bare bones are as follows. Lawrence Lessig will present, followed by a conversation between Shepard Fairey, Lawrence Lessig, and Stephen Johnson. Then questions from the blog and a few from our fabulous audience tonight. Let me thank our beer sponsor, the Brooklyn Brewery, for providing libations for our reception after the event. So thank you, Brooklyn, and thank you to its brewery. There, Alcohol always gets applause. There will be a signing after the event. Only books bought tonight will be signed. Thank you to our independent bookseller, 192 Books. And thank you once again to Wired Magazine for all your support, present, past, and I hope future. And thank you once again, one more time, Melanie Cornwell, and now Stephen Johnson.
All right. So I want to start by apologizing to Paul. He was very adamant leading up to this event that Lawrence Lessig and I do our best to get arrested to build buzz about this evening, and we both failed pretty miserably. I haven't paid a parking ticket in like 2 months. Nothing worked. So we're here, sadly, a little less controversial than we were hoping to be. But it's going to be a great night. I'm really excited about it. Honored to be here with these two guys. I think that what's exciting about this conversation is that it's both, in a sense, kind of timely and timeless. It's timely, obviously, in the sense that we have Shepard here, who really, and I think most of us would agree, created the iconic image of 2008 in many of our minds, and has been in the news in general. And of course, we have Lawrence Lessig, whose book Remix is really the definitive statement of how this culture is working and how it's going to work. We're in the news, we're in the middle of things happening right now. We're going to talk a lot about advanced technologies and how they're going to change the world and how they're going to change creativity. But what I wanted to just stress at the outset is to say that the issues here that we're wrestling with are old ones, and that they have actually quite deep roots in American culture, in fact, roots that go back hundreds of years. And I just wanted to tell one quick story to kind of set the stage to remind ourselves that this is not, in some sense, new, that these are old values that we're, in a sense, rediscovering. And so I just want to tell you this story that I kind of came across in the research of my last book, The Invention of Air, which I went into not thinking that it was going to be a book about remix culture and the open flow of information and kind of open source values. But the more I pursued this storyline, I realized that it was very much about those values. And it starts really with kind of the hero of the book, Joseph Priestley, who was a great 18th century kind of polymath figure, a pioneering chemist and scientist, a great political writer and an activist, and also a very prominent theologian. He co-founded the Unitarian Church in England in the 1770s. And one of the things that Priestley did in the early 1780s is he wrote an extremely controversial book called The History of the Corruptions of Christianity. And what this book basically argued was that the original message of kind of Christ's tenure on earth, that core kind of moral code that Christ had argued for, was extremely valuable and that one should orient oneself around that kind of ethical system, and that Christ's teachings were very, very much important and still alive in the world today. But Priestley believed that message had been corrupted over the years, and that layers and layers of kind of magic and superstition had been added to the story, and that it was really his work to go back and unearth all these extra elements that had been added by theologians and priests to kind of, in a sense, amaze people and spellbind them, and get back to that core story of Jesus' life without all the supernatural elements. And so he did this very extensive kind of archive work where he went through and found all these quotes and showed in this document all the distortions that have been added to the story over the years. And about 10 years later, it became an incredibly controversial book. An angry mob literally burned down his house because of what he'd written. But about 10 years later, it traveled across the Atlantic and was read by Thomas Jefferson. And it had an enormous impact on Jefferson. He would later write again and again about it, and it would say that his whole religious system basically rested on this book. And as most of you know, Jefferson had kind of wrestled with his faith, and when he found this book and realized that there was a way to kind of hold on to his Christianity without buying into all the supernatural elements, he decided that was the kind of religious value system that he was going to embrace for the rest of his life. And so he set out to create one of the great underground documents in the history of American culture, which many of you probably know about, which is Jefferson's Bible, we now colloquially call it. It's the life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted textually from the Gospels. This is the original American remix. And what Jefferson did is he went through the Bible and basically eliminated all the parts that weren't just about Jesus' message about how to live, and cut out all the magic bits, and cut out all the stuff about resurrection, and cut off all the stuff about walking across water, all those elements. And he just left that core story of what Jesus was trying to teach us. And of course, it was never published during his time. It was kind of this underground text. But the approach that he was taking is exactly the kind of approach that we're going to be talking about tonight. It was to take a bunch of documents, Priestley's document, the ideas from Priestley's books, to take them, recombine them, and take an actual text or series of texts, a series of books, and recombine them in new ways to create a new statement about the world, right? And what I want to stress here is that this is a very rich and powerful way of thinking about ideas and about culture. It is not trivial. It can be incredibly funny, but it can also be incredibly profound. And if you look, actually, wider than just Priestley and Jefferson, you look at the entire kind of Enlightenment era, Franklin was as much a part of this as Jefferson and Priestley were. What you find again and again is that they worked in this mode, that Enlightenment culture, the innovations of Enlightenment culture, were all about the open flow of information and the ability to grab things and remix them and put them in interesting new combinations. And Franklin has a wonderful line in one of his letters where he describes why he just kind of gives all of his data and his innovations and ideas away and publishes them as early as he can. Because he says that by getting ideas out into the open and allowing them to circulate, they will attract the attentions of the ingenious. And those intentions will improve the ideas themselves. That ideas get better when they flow, when they circulate. And so part of what I want us to be thinking about as we talk to these two amazing guys tonight is how odd it is, really, when we think about how rich this activity was that the American founders were so engaged with, this rich form of kind of remixing culture and recombining it. And yet, when we see the exact same practice being applied to someone doing the same thing to, I don't know, you know, a Prince song, that suddenly we feel like it's necessary to bring, you know, the United States Congress into it and an armada of lawyers. Then in a sense, that this is a way of thinking about the world that has very deep and, in a real sense, American roots. And so I think what we have to really get to, what with the opportunity we have now that the technology has kind of allowed us to really rethink these things, is really where we think innovation and creativity comes from. And do we think that fundamentally innovation and creativity comes from protecting ideas, building walls around them, or does it come from connecting ideas? I think if you go back through history, you'll find that the connective power of ideas has been an unbelievably strong force of innovation over the years. So we're going to talk about that in more detail. We're going to look at it in practice. But the first thing we're going to get to do is listen to one of the greatest guide to this that you could possibly imagine, the preeminent legal scholar on this and a wonderful writer, my friend Lawrence Lessig.
So my friend Tim Wu sent me this quote from Aldous Huxley, 1927. Huxley writes, "In the days before machinery, men and women who wanted to amuse themselves were compelled, in their humble way, to be artists. Now they sit still and permit professionals to entertain them by the aid of machinery. It is difficult to believe that general artistic culture can flourish in this atmosphere of passivity." Now, Huxley's message was actually first articulated to the United States Congress about a decade before by John Philip Sousa. Sousa was testifying about what he called the talking machines. This is what he had to say. "These talking machines are going to ruin the artistic development of music in this country. When I was a boy, in front of every house in the summer evenings, you would find young people together singing the songs of the day or the old songs. Today, you hear these infernal machines going night and day. We will not have a vocal cord left," Sousa said. "The vocal cords will be eliminated by a process of evolution, as was the tale of man when he came from the ape." Now, we're here tonight to celebrate a form of creativity. No one captures that form better than this man, Shepard Fairey. And he's been described by many as providing the artistic world something radically new, And indeed, he is the very first artist in the history of art to build upon earlier artistic creation. The very first one. No one ever thought about this idea before. And indeed, more than that, he is the very first artist ever to do this with photographs. No one ever thought before about taking a photograph and adapting it in some special way using the technology of the time. He is the man who came up with this idea, and he's the very first one to do it with politicians. No one ever had this idea before. And maybe most important, at least to those of us who celebrated this event, he was the very first one to make this extraordinary poster. Now, to make this poster, he was inspired and built upon a photograph. This photograph, which... That wasn't the photograph? Was that the photograph? No?
No, that one
didn't. That one? No. Was that the photograph? No. Oh, come on, Shepard. Was that the photograph?
No.
How about this one? Come on. It's pretty close, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, but that? No? This one?
Nope.
This one. That's it. Okay. He was inspired to build upon this photograph and create something new, create this extraordinary poster, a poster that captured a spirit and motivated a movement. And then other people were inspired by him, this fantastic website, which allows you to create Shepard Fairey-like photographs however you'd like. So I took my five-year-old, I uploaded it. There he is, my five-year-old is Hope. I then took my two-year-old and uploaded it. There my is two-year-old tongue. Okay, so of course, there's nothing radically new in this story. There's the continuation of a form of expression and celebration that has been with us from the beginning of artistic expression. And it's, of course, not just Shepard. It is a spirit of the time. Think in the context, for example, of music. Everybody knows this album, The White Album, by the Beatles, which inspired Jay-Z to make this album, The Black Album, which then inspired DJ Danger Mouse 5 years ago Tuesday to produce this extraordinary album, The Grey Album, which synthesizes the tracks of The White Album and Black Album together to produce something grey. That's 5 years ago. The modern equivalent of this, Girl Talk, can mix 230 different tracks together to produce something new. Or think about something called anime music videos. Everybody knows what anime are, these cartoons increasingly sweeping American culture. Anime music videos are produced by people synchronizing these images to music, re-editing them to express something different, something as trivial as this, or this. Maybe most important has been the extraordinary examples in the context of politics. Of course, remix wasn't something in the last cycle that Shepard practiced alone. This became a symbol of the early stage of the Obama campaign expressing Obama's message in this remix precisely.
It was a creed written into the founding documents that declared the destiny of the nation. Yes, we can.
And not just pro-Obama.
Good evening.
The first,
the second,
third, and last presidential debate.
I'm Jim Brokaw, NBC News.
By now, we've heard all the talking points. So let's try to tell the people tonight some things that they they haven't heard.
Thank you, Bob.
Tom, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you,
University.
I think everybody understands.
I think everybody knows now we are going through the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression.
8 years of failed economic policies promoted by
President Bush and supported by Senator McCain.
And our best days are ahead of us.
Senator McCain's statement earlier said that he thought the fundamentals of the economy were sound.
Let's look at as graded by the National Taxpayers Union and the Citizens Against Government Waste.
Senator McCain talks a lot about earmarks.
Likes to talk about earmarks a lot.
Let's be clear about earmarks.
Earmarks account for about $18 billion of our budget.
In last year's budget. And when I'm president, I will go line by line
through every item.
Page by page.
So when Senator McCain is proposing a $300
still, my very favorite is this. This is the last time I can show this one, I think.
My love, there's only you in my life, the only thing that's bright.
My first love, you're every breath that I take, you're every step I make.
Those are examples of extraordinary creative stuff broadcast in this new medium. But we miss what's extraordinary about Remix if we focus on this broadcast alone. Think about what's developing in contests like YouTube. So here's a video I came across on YouTube. 1.7 million people saw this video. It then inspired this video. Of course, about 3.2 million people watched this video. And there are at least 10 others that I found doing exactly the same thing. Or everybody knows this extraordinary. So SNL remixed this a bit. But much better than SNL were amateurs remixing it. Literally scores of these on YouTube. But my very favorite one. Or, here's a different trend.
Soulja Boy, tell me. Hey, I got this new dance for y'all called the Soulja Boy. You gotta punch, then crank back 3 times from left to right.
So this video inspired this one.
Soulja Boy, tell me. Hey, I got this new dance for y'all called the Soulja Boy. You gotta punch, then crank back 3 times from left to right.
This one.
Soulja Boy, tell me. Hey, I got the new dance for y'all called the Soulja Boy. You just gotta punch, then crank back 3 times from left to right.
So the point is, these are conversations that's happening in this space. It's the modern equivalent of what Sousa spoke of when he spoke of the young people together singing the songs of the day, or the old songs, but not on the corner and the back lawns, but in the presence of this platform that invites people from around the world to participate. It is showing us that Huxley was wrong. The atmosphere of passivity has been transformed. So much is not new. There is something that is new. Bizarre as this may seem, after hundreds of years of balance and respect for the creative process, there's been an explosion in a new approach by the law to these efforts and expressions of creativity. This is my favorite example. This is Holden. Holden's 13 months old. When his mother, Stephanie, saw Holden dancing, she grabbed her digital camera and captured it. And she then wanted her mother to see it, so she did what any mother of the 21st century does. She uploaded this to YouTube, Holden dancing. After a couple months, she got a notice that the copyright owners to that music had informed YouTube that the material infringed their copyrights and they demanded it be taken down. Now, where are we when serious people sitting around a serious conference table can look at this and think it's important to invoke the laws of our Congress to protect the extraordinary abuse of this mother sharing the celebration of her child with her mother? Or you all know this extraordinary photo poster has inspired a lawsuit because the copyright owners of this photograph that was based on demand payment for the right to build upon that in a way that celebrates this extraordinary politician. Now, when you look at these issues, you should say, what should the law do about this question of remix? How should we regulate it? We regulate it through this doctrine called copyright. So we should think about, what is copyright actually for? What is its purpose here? And of course, copyright's legitimate and important purpose is to produce incentives for authors to create. It functions by restricting speech. Copyrighted work cannot be copied freely and shared with everybody in the world, but the objective is to produce more speech. So we limit freedom in order to produce more free speech. But obviously, we should be limiting freedom only where we are actually producing more free speech. And whenever the government wants, through regulation, to limit speech, we should recognize this regulation imposes costs, and we should make sure the benefits from that regulation exceed the costs. So, for example, imagine Congress passed a rule that said you needed permission when writing, whenever you wanted to quote someone. So, the person who wrote this passage, quoting lots of people in the passage, would have to contact the author of the work that he or she was quoting and ask, may I quote this? And the author could say, yes or no, or here's how you can do it, here's how much money you have to pay me. Now, the thing to recognize is, of course, is this regulation is possible, and in some theoretical sense, it even would benefit writers, those whose work would be quoted. But as all of you have as an intuitive sense, the cost of that regulation would wildly overwhelm the benefit, and therefore we don't regulate the right to quote. You're free to quote as long as you cite, and plagiarism is, in my view, the only offense deserving the death penalty, but you're free to quote as long as you cite. That's what free expression involves. Now, that's the same question we have here. Same question that exists in Remix. And we could understand this question by thinking of two possible rules that could govern Remix. Number one, we could have a presumption that says you need permission for everything you would remix. Or number two, we could have a rule that says the presumption is it's free. If we had a presumption of permission, then just think every single time people like Greg Gillis or Stephanie Lentz wanted to remix things, they would have to seek permission. But as you think about what that would do, what the consequences of that rule would be, it's clear the benefit of such a rule to artists would be tiny. There, see, it's really tiny. Because such permission could not possibly change the incentives the original artist had when the original artist made the work that is being remixed. So it's no great benefit, but the costs to the second generation of creators are huge. The cost especially to amateurs and young artists and controversial artists. For them, to get permission would be impossible, so they couldn't possibly create legally. It would drive this creativity underground, make them, quote, criminals. That's the world where the rule says permission. The world where the presumption is free is radically different. The costs of this rule are tiny, because the effect on incentives of freely allowing remix, incentives for the original author to create, would be tiny. But the benefit here would be huge. Because if this remix is clearly legal, even if not one more person would be engaging in remix, even if you believe kids will remix regardless of what the law says, if it's legal, then we can begin to teach and share and celebrate this form of creativity in a way that we can't today. So if we think about this in the context of the purpose of copyright, my view is it's clear we should be deregulating this form of expression. Remix should be free of regulation to facilitate it to flourish in the way that it already is in so many contexts. But as you know, that's not the law's response here. We don't see less regulation in this context, we see more regulation in this context. We're waging senseless, hopeless wars about this violation of copyrights, wars referred to as the copyright wars, or what my friend, the late Jack Valenti, used to refer to as his own, quote, terrorist war, where apparently the terrorists in this war are our children. Now, this war of terrorism here is threatening artists like Shepard Fairey or Candice Brights or even Jeff Koons and people like Stephanie Lenz. It's threatening kids. The RIAA is suing more than 28,000 kids for using material on the net illegally, according to the RIAA, but to no effect, because the one thing we know about peer-to-peer file sharers is they apparently don't read Supreme Court opinions. Here's where the Supreme Court declared peer-to-peer file sharing presumptively illegal, but there was no real change in what the behavior was. So the law becomes a tool to stop a form of expression that is increasingly defining this generation of creators. Now, for many years, a decade, I spent my life, as tenured professors tend to do, going around thinking that the policymakers in this context were a bunch of idiots. And then after about a decade, I realized that the idiot was actually me. Because I looked at this and I thought, they're idiots, because these are a bunch of easy public policy questions which they just get wrong. So a decade ago, Congress passed the statute in honor of this man, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which extended the term of existing copyrights by 20 years. The question Congress should ask is, does this advance the public good? Well, when we challenged this statute in the Supreme Court, this left-wing Nobel Prize winner, oh wait, that's a right-wing Nobel Prize winner, Milton Friedman, said he would join the brief declaring that there's no possible way that this could advance the public good only if the word no-brainer existed in the brief somewhere. But apparently there were no brains in this place when they passed that brief, that law. So this easy public policy question Congress got wrong, and this was the sort of thing that led me to believe that they were just idiots. But it was I who was the idiot. Because the mistakes of Congress here have nothing to do with stupidity. The mistakes of Congress here have to do everything with the economy of influence that drives Washington to pass the rules it passes. They seek in Washington not sense, but campaign dollars. And it's that seeking that drives them to these insane public policy choices. So, for example, just this week, this man, Congressman John Conyers from Detroit, Michigan, introduced for the second Congress in a row this bill, 801. House Resolution 801 functions like this. We have something like the National Institute of Health that commissions all sorts of research. The bill that Conyers introduced said that it would be illegal for the National Institute of Health to require that research be freely accessible by any American. The law says they can't require open access for this research. They must allow publishers the exclusive right to control the distribution of research to Americans that we have paid for. Now, we distribute this research in journals that cost literally thousands of dollars a year. So we have an economy where the author writes these articles for free, the reviewers review the articles for free, they get published and nobody gets paid for anything, but the publisher collects money from the distribution of the knowledge the United States government has paid to create. Now, when I saw this, I thought, wow, I didn't realize there were publishers in Detroit. But of course, there are no publishers in Detroit. Indeed, the main beneficiaries of this law are foreign publishers. So this is the opposite of the idiotic Buy American provision in the stimulus bill. It's the Foreign Publishers Protection Act, which Congress now would enact because Congressman Conyers thinks we should enact it. Now, this law doesn't have one Nobel Prize winner who opposes it. There are 33 Nobel Prize winners who have said that this is an outrageous intervention into the spread of knowledge in the way Jefferson would have celebrated. Indeed, the former and current heads of the NIH say that this would harm science in America. It is a no-brainer if there is a no-brainer. So why is it Conyers is pushing this law? Well, today, in fact, 1 hour ago, MapLight organization, which studies the relationship between money and politics, produced a study that demonstrates that those who co-sponsored this bill received twice as much money from publishers as those on the committee that didn't. Now, this is a practice that's simple to describe. It is called corruption. I don't mean it's graft. I don't mean anybody was bribed. I don't mean that Conyers is trying to feather his own nest. These are good people, no doubt. But they are good people who live in and don't change a corrupted system. And in such a system, it is no surprise that idiotic rules rule. Now, I've changed my work. This is the last time I get to come here and talk about these extraordinary subjects, because my view is that we need to change this. And this is the focus of my work for the next decade of my life, but this is not the focus of our conversation tonight. The focus of our conversation tonight is the creativity celebrated in work like this. But let me bring it back then, in closing, to this creativity. The one thing we should recognize is that we cannot kill this form of expression, we can only criminalize it. We can't stop our kids from being active in ways that we or I wasn't growing up. We can only drive them underground. We can't make them passive. We can only make them, quote, pirates. And the question is that any good? Our kids live in a time, an age of prohibitions, constantly living life against the law. Normal behavior is deemed to be criminal behavior. Now, that life is extraordinarily corrosive. It is extraordinarily corrupting. It is corrupting of the rule of law and the very ideals of a democracy. We have got to do better, if not for the RIAA and the Motion Picture Association of America, at least for them. Thank you very much. Sir, should we come up?
I'll be in the center.
Thanks.
Great stuff. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Shepard Fairey. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to start by letting Shepard talk a little bit about his work in a slightly more conversational mode. So if Larry and I get inspired or want to show our own artwork, we can if we want to. Shepard's going to walk us through a couple of crucial pieces in his history as an artist and talk about them. And then we're going to open it up to a more general conversation, and then we're going to open it up to an even more general conversation. So do you have control of the... Here, I'm going to pass the baton to you.
To the right?
That's right.
Yeah.
unlike politics, forward is to the right.
Forcing you to the right, Shepard.
Okay. Anybody know this image? Seen this image before? I copyright infringement. I got a long history with that, I guess. I started in 1989 with this this inside joke with a few skateboarder friends of Andre the Giant, the wrestler, who I just happened to choose as a picture out of a magazine or a newspaper to teach a friend how to make a stencil, and wrote Andre the Giant has a posse, which posse was a big hip hop slang word, and that would be for our group of friends, our posse. So immediately, this had nothing to do with wrestling. It had to do with a quirky image that my friends and I could turn into an inside joke. And when people would say, "What's this Andre the Giant posse thing about?" we could say, "Sorry, it's top secret. We're not allowed to tell you if you don't know." But this image, though it started off in a very, very nonchalant, silly way, once I put a few stickers around Providence, Rhode Island, where I was going to the Rhode Island School of Design at the time, people started to talk about it. And then I heard people talking about whether it was a band or had to do with skateboarding or whatever in the grocery store. And then the local free paper ran a contest saying, "Does anyone know what the Andre the Giant has a posse sticker campaign is about?" And I realized very quickly that, first of all, that images in public space that weren't advertising actually renewed a sense of wonder about public space. And I started to look into this concept of phenomenology, which is the idea of reawakening a sense of wonder about one's environment. And it also made me think about the control of public space, that most of the dialogue in public space is about things that have some sort of commercial benefit. So I think this speaks to Larry's, look at what the agenda is and look where the money is. And a lot of times things will clear up really quickly. So I thought about the control of public space and the idea of an image provoking a conversation about that. And that's how I got going. I quickly evolved that image because I was like, "Oh, I've got an audience for this image that's really silly. What do I do now? Maybe I'll evolve it into a version of the counterculture, Big Brother is watching you," and get people to question the idea of just submitting to the idea that it can be a one-way conversation with advertising, that anything can encroach on the visual horizon as long as it's paid for, but the moment you put something out there that says, "Well, here's what I think, if it's not paid for, you're a criminal." So the next version, of course, was Obey. Obey and Giant. Andre the Giant started it, but Obey was really the thing, that the idea that people follow the path of least resistance, frequently justifying a degree of cooperation, even though they're not happy with being controlled. But then when you tell them to directly obey, they actually are very offended. So, yeah, I guess that was my idea, to agitate. We're talking about remix, and we're talking about the power of reference. I mean, the Andre the Giant thing didn't actually reference anything that I felt was significant that I was building upon. And in fact, it was its ambiguity that I think created a lot of people wondering a conversation about what it was, like a Rorschach test, like an inkblot test, which I found, fascinating. But then I also felt like I wanted to build on some of the concepts of 1984, so I evolved it into this more Orwellian Big Brother image. This is an example of remix that I think is fairly strong because the Greetings from Iraq image is so much more potent if you realize what the reference is. The reference, of course, is this Yellowstone poster. It's an escapist destination in the United States. It's very beautiful. And then you have the war in Iraq. That's a bad situation for the U.S. soldiers. It's a bad situation for the Iraqis. And in one slide, it's a geyser, and something to go see. Woo, the geyser! And then it's an explosion, and in the next one, something to run from. I've made some images that remixed some political leaders, and back in 2003, 2004, I wasn't too excited about the war, so I did some stuff of George Bush. And how am I going to comment about George Bush unless I illustrate a likeness of George Bush, and if I want to talk about the things George Bush is doing, can I put him in a scenario that is symbolic but not something he's literally ever done necessarily? And is that a useful tool of communication? I think yes. This is actually based on the official presidential portrait, which I found out is public domain. I don't know if George Bush or the photographer would have necessarily approved of this reinterpretation, yet I think the statement, with many people censoring themselves and being begrudgingly complicit due to sort of the moment that we were in and the atmosphere of fear, I felt it was important to say something that I think was letting people know it was okay to be vocal, that you weren't stoked on Bush, you know. So that brings us to this, which we'll see this 80 times tonight. But this is the collage version. This is the real art version. Anyway, this Barack Obama, I wanted to make an image that I felt represented Barack Obama as someone who was not outside the mainstream, like the right wing was trying to portray him. Someone who had the characteristics of leadership. He could bring change, hope, progress, and that he was a patriot. So the colors were very important, and the idea of the blue and the red, the blue states and the red states converging right there in the middle where we can't we all get along, was very important to this image. And finding a reference that would allow me to illustrate that, I looked through a lot, and as you saw in Lawrence's presentation, there are a lot of different images I could have worked from, and I chose the Manny Garcia photo, and now I'm being litigated against. So here's some other versions. After I made that image and it got some traction on the internet and I sent out thousands of posters all on my own dime, the Obama campaign said, "We really like the style of that image. We have some images that you could work from. Would you do one for us?" So I did change. And then later, Time Magazine asked me, "Your image really made an impact on this election cycle. We think it became really iconic. Could you do something similar for our cover?" And the interesting thing about this is that you can see that the red and the blue are on opposite sides. His head is leaning the opposite way. His mouth is open. But many, many people said to me, "It's so great that your hope image ended up on the cover of Time Magazine." So really, there's so many ways that an image derives its power. And, I would contend that the illustration style, the idealization of an image, the style in which it's illustrated, the way it's been colored, and its implementation, that I spent hundreds, if not maybe more hours just putting this image out there and rallying many, many different people to help distribute the image, that then it became a symbol due to how it was very, very diligently perpetuated. Where does this image derive, or the hope image derive its real cultural currency from? And I think that there are a lot of variables that need to be taken into account. So, now we see some of the offshoots, and you see that most of the spoofs were based on, actually they're all based on the style of the image, the colors of the image. And that's a really important part of artistic communication. Here's a bunch of spoofs of the Andre the Giant image. It's my opinion and the Obey image, that these are wonderful. Even if they're criticizing my image has become the reference point. It's become the symbol. And every spoof, whether it's for or against, actually gives more power to the original. I would say the same thing about the photo reference for the Obama. That actually it was a Darfur photo from a panel in 2006 Darfur panel with George Clooney and Barack Obama that actually was not even relevant in terms of news anymore, and was a very very unspectacular, unexceptional photo. But now that it became this poster, it's actually given a lot more value to the original. So, you know, those are the real points that I wanted to touch on. I've got tons of examples of remix. Remix has been a really important part of my body of work because references that a lot of people understand are a great way to establish where you're coming from in a piece of communication. As an artist, I'm very much a populist, and I believe that connecting with as many people as possible through accessible metaphors is crucial to what I do. So it's a really big part of my work.
So you hinted at this, but why do you think about what do you think about that image? What was it that really caused it to resonate the way that it did? I mean, why did it, of all the images circulating around, of all the campaign images that were out there by the campaign, by other people, why do you think that one kind of took hold?
Well, I think now that the image has become, a symbol, really, you've got to look back to the beginning of when I created it over a year ago, the middle of January 2008. No one had created a really iconic image of Obama, and of course the campaign had some really strong materials, the logo, the very sophisticated graphics. But I think that if you watch Obama speak, he has a manner that is very appealing, and this Pavlovian association maybe that's not the right analogy. This euphoric association. You're going to get a steak later after I ring the bell. I think Obama's very compelling, and that a portrait really reminded people of his power as an orator and his perceived integrity and idealism in a way that a slogan or a logo or a website or any other graphic device could not compete with. And so it was just a matter of creating the correct portrait for the right moment. And really the strength of it is derived from the strength of Barack Obama and the amount of emotional investment that a lot of people had in Barack Obama as a leader. So, forget me, forget Manny Garcia. The real thing is that the image was about Obama. And so I think that people were worried that there would be the Bradley effect, that people would perceive Obama as, ooh, he's not white, he's half black. That illustrating him in red, white, and blue, for me, seemed basically mandatory for a contemporary political graphic. They've all been so safe. This is one of the most safe mainstream graphics I've ever created. But still, some people were like, oh my God, it looks so socialist and edgy and weird, you know? And I just thought that was very bizarre. But, I tried to make an image that represented my style but could transcend the niche that I'm usually seen in and appeal to the mainstream and be seen as a patriotic image where, the guy's portraying hope and change and progress. And I don't know really what made it work other than it was the right moment to make that image. It was needed.
You know, it seems to me, and I'm the last person to be an art critic in this context, but it seems to me that there's one thing that you did add to it that you should give yourself more credit for, which is that because your work draws upon so much kind of historic iconography and that kind of socialist propaganda kind of iconography that we've seen some examples of, it seems to me that there's something about that image that you really added to it, not just the face, but all the way that it's designed, that put Obama in the middle of that competition, in the middle of Iowa, and in the pettiness of a political campaign, that made him look historic, right? That there was this kind of temporality to it that was suddenly there where you could see him and he looked suddenly like Che, or he looked like all these kind of iconic figures that we've been staring at in images like that over the last decades. And suddenly it kind of pulled him out of the momentary kind of fighting between, Hillary and Obama. And it set him on a kind of a larger stage in this way. And I think that's a big part of why it resonated for people as well, I think.
Well, the idea that something was worthy of being treated as an icon, I think a lot of people, they respond to very intuitively, and then they look for an intellectual justification of why they think, okay, this guy's been portrayed as an icon, maybe he deserved it, maybe I should figure out why, or, oh, this guy, he's an imposter. And now I have to figure out why he's not the real deal and why he shouldn't be portrayed this way. And then they go check out his website and they're won over and it's a done deal. So, yeah.
But there's something else that you did, which was, this was an authentic expression of grassroots support for the candidate. And what's so important about the success of Obama was the suggestion, which you helped make real, that this was not just a central command campaign run by a bunch of professionals. It was about inspiring a class of people who were not part of politics in the last 20 years. So the fact that they could point to this thing they had nothing to do with creating that became such an important part of the popular culture was another way of ratifying what his campaign was about.
Well, I think that that's a really important point. The idea that usually the two-party system is seen as controlled by a very, very small group of affluent people that, you know, first of all, you know, Obama, a lot of people thought was, you know, the alternative to the Hillary juggernaut, which was just the next phase of a dynasty. And I actually, you know, like a lot of Hillary's views, but I think symbolically it was really important for Obama that, you know, that Obama was coming from a different place. And then, you know, the image being a grassroots image, being seeming of the people, by the people, I think was something that was very, very influential because grassroots art that's embraced by a lot of people that, you know, if you're doing Gladwell speak or whatever, would be tastemakers, influencers. They take that image and they share it with their friends and in what's going on with modern technology, it was email signatures, Facebook, and MySpace. And it ended up, because I had a free download on my website, so people printed out copies, but they also just grabbed the JPEGs, and it was on blogs. I mean, it spread like crazy on the internet, and it really felt like it was something not generated by the campaign, but generated in a genuine grassroots way. And I completely agree with you that that was such a powerful component of it.
Can you say something about the grassroots campaign you're working on in terms of the legal element? Asking
people, we want you to make a poster for it, actually. Well, do you mean the Change Congress or
just trying to track down the other similar, you were asking users to help.
Oh, that's right.
Them,
yeah. So at Stanford, I run the Center for Internet and Society. We have a fair use project, which has been defending artists in a wide range of contexts, including people who are being threatened by the James Joyce estate, people threatened by Yoko Ono, people threatened by the Harry Potter. So when we heard about Shepard's troubles, we volunteered, and so we are now Shepard's lawyer. We have a fantastic lawyer, Tony Falzone, who's the head of this, who's running the campaign, and has told us exactly what we're not allowed to say and what we can talk about. But we then, I just launched on my blog a kind of crowdsourced defense, which was help us gather the kind of knowledge a court needs to understand why this is part of what art has always been. So I asked them to provide both the images that were similar to the image that he gave, and you saw some of them that I showed here, but also images from art history that help, you know, idiot lawyers like me and judges who are just slightly less idiotic like me, understand why this is what art has always been. And there's been scores of people who've sent in extraordinarily detailed and some not so helpful, but some a lot of it very helpful stuff to say because they believe that this is an important fight to fight. The idea that this expression becomes the subject of federal litigation is just a measure of just how screwed up this federal system has become.
Well, a point I want to make about it is that I am, first of all, when I made the image, I had no idea it was going to become what it's become. And I actually believe that copyright is important in some instances. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. He's a lawyer. Wow, what a slip, huh? I'm learning all the lawyer talk
so
now, but I'm not a lawyer. I'm an artist, so I really believe that, you know, anything that stifles one's ability to communicate and express themselves is undesirable. But I do believe in intellectual property. But when the AP approached me after one whole year of the image being out there, and in every interview I did, I acknowledged that I did a Google search and used a reference from the internet that was an AP photo. You know, they said, okay, we own this image, we want damages, you know, you're going to have to submit to our will, you know, and
obey.
And I said, well, you know, I don't think I should have to, but if it'll make you feel better, I'll pay what would have been the original licensing fee for the image. And they said, no, we want damages. And I said, what damages? Your photo's worth way more now than it would have been worth. And I thought about it, and I said, you know, do I really want to complicate my life having to fight the AP? I made the image to help Obama. That's done. Do I even really care now what happens with it? And I had put all the money back into making posters, donating to charity, or donating to Obama's campaign. And that was my intention of what to do with any revenue from it. But I thought, well, since it's not about the money, it's about a lot of artists who aren't in the position that I'm in, where if, hey, up against the wall, I can license an image if I need to. And to avoid legal hassle, I may have to do that in a lot of cases. I'm high profile now. I might be watched closely. But for every young artist who made an Obama poster during this cycle, who did it in the exact same way that I did, they worked from a reference from the internet, and it was a very profound impact, I think, that these artists made. Or every poster artist that made something against Bush in 2004 that might have actually been the seed that germinated into people making pro-Obama posters this time. Is it really fair for the AP to send a ripple of fear out to that entire community that they will not make art for fear of having, you know, Congress coming after them for copyright law? And I said, you know, this is something that I need to fight just for the sake of artists in general, not just for me.
So one of the things we have here that... I think in a deliberate way, we've set this up as a panel with a lot of consensus. But I'm going to try and instigate a little bit here, just so it doesn't get too touchy-feely and be kind of verbally abusive for the rest of the night. To ask you a couple of questions, one or two for you too, Larry. Where do you draw the line? I mean, think about your own work, when somebody appropriates your own work and manipulates it in some ways. Where, you know, what are the points at which, I think we have probably a lot of consensus in the room that some form of remixing is important. So the problem then becomes, how do you define the boundaries of it? I mean, do you have a clear sense of that in your head, or is it a kind of case-by-case?
It's absolutely a case-by-case basis. The people that work with me, I do a clothing line that's a licensing deal, and I have people that are always trying to look out for my interests. Actually, I frequently don't listen to them because I want to err on the side of allowing people frequently to use my images, as long as it's you know, something that's transformative, or even if it's not transformative, if it's such small scale that I see something of myself when I was the kid with a Xerox machine in my mom's office running off copies of my favorite album covers to cut stencils from to make my own t-shirts. Did I want, like, the FBI showing up at my house to bust me for one Sex Pistols shirt I made, you know? I think a lot of it has to do with a case by case. The instances, though, where I will go after someone is if the work isn't transformed in any way and it's made purely for exploitative profit. I actually went after some of the people that bootlegged the Obama image because I had given all the money from the image to the ACLU and the movement to overturn Prop 8 in California. And if one guy we knew had bragged about buying a Mercedes with the profits from bootleg posters, I said, you know what? You know, the ACLU might really need a Mercedes. I'd love to get that for them. It's really a case-by-case basis, but I definitely think I have free downloads of a lot of my images on my website, that if it is used as a tool of communication or not-for-profit, I'm never going to have a problem with it. And some people have said, you know, you have to protect your mark. And, you know, the things that inspired me to make art were about frequently being irreverent towards the idea of protected marks. So it's, you know, I think that it's all in the spirit of what I do. And the only things that I'm going to go after are real, just straight bootlegging operations.
Yeah, it's an important line to try to draw, because some people think that this debate is between those who want to make money and those on the free culture side who don't think money should be earned by anybody anywhere. And that's not the division, right? Artists have got to make money. Artists have got to earn enough money to be able to flourish and do their art. That's the purpose of the copyright system, and that's an important purpose for the system to play. The critical thing is to draw the distinction between places where somebody is, quote, ripping you off and places where they've been inspired by you, and to celebrate that inspiration. And what I've been excited about, and the reason I'm kind of optimistic about this issue now, which is a problem for me because I'm so depressed and pessimistic about everything that I just can't hang around the free culture debate anymore. That's why I've got to go to corruption, where I will never be optimistic about anything. Is that some of the biggest, most powerful, you know, bullies in this field are getting it. So, for example, Viacom has a lawsuit against YouTube that I think has no basis in law. But anyway, they have that lawsuit. But Viacom also has a very sharp distinction, where they say, you know, if you take a Colbert show and you upload it to YouTube and don't do anything to it, we will take it down within 24 hours. We will notice them right away. But if you do anything to it, if you remix it at all, if you express some creative on top of the stuff you've taken, we won't touch it. Now, they're not saying they're licensing it. They're not saying you're free to do it. But they're saying we're going to exercise restraint so that we encourage one kind of creativity that we think celebrates our work while stopping a kind of abuse that is obviously competing with their business model. Now, if more businesses behaved like that, I think we could get back to a balance that really made sense of exactly the line you're trying to draw. But too many of these businesses are controlled, I'm sorry to say, by lawyers who think about this as a religious question, like the right has been violated, we have to stop the violation of the right, without ever asking, does it really help our business or hurt our business that people are creatively remixing and spreading our creativity?
Let me ask a question about the actual expressive range of the art. I thought it was interesting, and this may be somewhat self-selected by the purposes of an audience and this kind of crowd, but if you looked at all the examples you showed, I would say 90-95% of the kind of major kind of expressive modes were pretty much comic satire. They were jokes. They were very appealing. There was some political edge to some of them, obviously, in the Blair Bush love story. But the mode was decidedly about, you know, quick visual gags of superimposing things. And I think, particularly when you look at kind of video and audio mashups, particularly video mashups, that's not radically unrepresentative of what's been out there. Do you think that shows some kind of limitation in what's possible, or why has it skewed in that direction thus far?
I think exactly the opposite. I think it shows something about the enormous potential for this, because, you know, satire, especially political satire that's actually effective, is very hard to do well. Right? If you tried to write something that was as powerful as that Bush Blair video, you couldn't do it. You couldn't, in 800 words in an op-ed in the New York Times, convey the same power and reflective sense of just how emasculated Blair had become in response to America as this video did. So the point is, because we are a culture that is so deeply surrounded by music and images, and we learn to communicate like this, this form of literacy has a potential that exceeds the potential of words for us right now. I mean, you know, what is The Daily Show except the most important political commentary America has every single day, right? Mm-hmm. And it's astonishing, but it's because it uses these images in exactly that way. So I think that, you know, if you want to do history, we're actually seeing a lot of great remix history in the same form. You don't want to do philosophy, I still think you're going to have to stick to words. But political satire and reflection like this, I think increasingly we ought to encourage this literacy, teach it, and allow it to spread so that we can see exactly what it produces.
I wanted to ask you also about this shift. It was great to see some of this kind of preview of coming lesser attractions with the corruption thing. Did you? I'm intrigued by the whole idea of kind of the 10-year plan. Did you think you were going to do something like this 10 years ago? Did you imagine that your kind of intellectual life would evolve with these kind of larger blocks of time and that you would move to something else? Or is it something that kind of occurred to you on the fly?
No. So a decade ago, it was actually about 15 years ago when I started as an academic, I kind of imagined being in the stacks academic who just read books and wrote things that nobody ever read. And that was kind of liberating because didn't really care, you know, how good it was. I just was working things out. Nobody was going to read it. And then I tripped onto this activism around free culture, really as a lawyer with a guilty conscience. I just felt like the lawyers were doing such damage here. And in fact, our tradition, our legal tradition, was so much richer and better than where we had come that I felt like I had to do something about it. But it was actually Obama and Gore together that flipped me. So Obama has, in his book, The Audacity of Hope, this image of, you know, 10 years he'd been in the business of being a politician, and he told his wife it was up or out. He was going to run for the Senate up or out. And I had the sense of how important it was to liberate yourself from what you were good at, right? And I said, that's a great idea. I'm going to throw away all of my intellectual capital after every 10 years and force myself to relearn a whole new field, because otherwise you get old very quick. So that was number one. And number two was Al Gore. You know, so Al Gore had done extraordinary work forcing us to see the consensus scientists had forever about global warming. But one of the things Gore says, if you listen carefully to what he's talking about, is that this problem of global warming was affected by exactly the kind of corruption that I'm talking about. And it hit me, you know, again, this is an obvious point, and it would only take an idiot 10 years to recognize this point, but it took me 10 years to recognize this point, that it wasn't just esoteric areas like copyright where money was actually buying stupid results. It was the most important public policy questions America is facing. Money is buying stupid results. And so if it's the most important and the most esoteric that is being corrupted by the way the system works right now, it struck me that there was no better issue to confront. And, you know, I am enormously lucky. I'm not wealthy, but I have tenure, which means I don't get paid to say what I'm saying. I get to say whatever I want. You know, many people have tenure, trust me, I live with them, say idiotic things all the time, and many of you might think I say idiotic things all the time, but it's really great to have people in our society who get to say what they believe, not what they're hired to say. And so that was the opportunity that I thought, having the position I did and some notoriety and opportunity at places like MIPL to talk about it, made sense for me to give up the hopeful task of free culture and turn to the dark of corruption.
We're going to shortly open it up for conversation. I wanted to just ask both of you for your thoughts just about these issues and this new administration. Where do you think, what's going on? There we go. Just going to start cycling.
To the satire, the humor of the remix is, this is really silly, right? But it's a lot harder to make Andre the Giant appealing than it is to make Marilyn Monroe appealing, right? Is this, you know, my little commentary.
So that's great.
But anyway, yeah, same. I think that humor is a really important aspect of social commentary, so I completely agree with Larry. But let's talk about Obama.
Yeah, do we feel optimistic about these particular issues in this new administration? Do we feel that there is an opportunity to really have this conversation and start reinventing some of our assumptions about how copyright, for instance, should work and how fair use should work? Do we get the sense that it's going to be better, or until you solve this corruption problem, it's going to stay? It's going to stay the way it is.
Well, so Obama is facing an enormous range of crises, you know, and I kind of liken it to, imagine you have cancer and you're going to the hospital to start chemotherapy, and on the way to the hospital you have a massive car accident, right? That's kind of our nation today, right? Obama was constantly talking about how we had to change the way Washington worked. We were on our way to doing that. And then we had the, you know, car accident of these extraordinary crises that that befell the country. And just like the analogy suggests, you go to the hospital, there's a trauma unit that's going to stabilize the patient and then hand off to the reform candidate, so too that's our nation right now. And so Obama is trying to stabilize. It's the trauma unit. And there's a million enormous problems that he's got to address before we can get on to some of these other issues. So the critical issue for me, and I've not yet seen clear signal that he is going to do this, but the critical issue for me is whether he commits his administration to fundamentally reforming the way Washington works, which is something more than, you know, this kind of idiot bipartisanship, right? Bipartisanship got us into Iraq, right? That we were bipartisan about our commitment to Iraq. What we need is someone who's going to say that the way Congress functions right now is broken, deeply flawed, and we have to change it fundamentally. And the simplest way to change it, in my view, is to establish something that Teddy Roosevelt argued for 102 years ago, which is citizen funding of the nation's elections, so that no matter how stupid they do, whatever they do that's idiotic, you can't possibly think it's because of the money. It might be because there are more Republicans than Democrats and more Democrats than Republicans, but it's not the money. So you can begin to have some faith that we can engage with them about the authentic issue that they're talking about without believing that there's this thing in the background. He has not yet signaled this is his issue. He was a co-sponsor of a public funding bill in the last Congress, the Durbin-Specter bill. It will be introduced again in the next week. We'll see his position on that. And the real question for me is whether he's going to be strong on it. The IP issues, it's also an open question. Again, there are a million more important issues than the IP issues. But he's appointed some very pro-IP extremist people to the Justice Department, people who used to prosecute on behalf of the RIAA. There's not yet anybody appointed in this mix who comes from the other side, who comes from the side that signals the importance about the free culture, open science-like issues. Now, I do believe he gets it, and critical people in the administration get it. He committed the transition to licensing all of its content under Creative Commons licenses. The Whitehouse.gov explicitly says everything we do is in the public domain. Anything that's contributed to this site is under a Creative Commons license. So it's not like they're not aware of it. But you put your finger on it. You know, when Al Gore was vice president and they were thinking about healthcare, Al Gore said to Clinton, "You've got to deal with campaign finance before you deal with healthcare, because you will never get healthcare if you don't deal with campaign finance." And Clinton said, "No, we're going to go after health care." And of course, we didn't get health care. And I think that's the same insight Obama's got to have here. You've got to deal with campaign finance before we get not the stimulus passed, but health care that really does anything, a global warming solution that really does something, all of these areas where the moneyed interests can direct the solution in a way that's no solution at all. Only changing Washington's economy of influence will make that change possible.
And from the art side, Shepard, I mean, how does it feel to you? I mean, is it going to be harder to be less oppositional?
Well, I'm actually relishing the opportunity to support something.
Right.
I think that it's important to maintain a critical eye, but I also think that, we have an opportunity that we haven't had for at least the last 8 years. To maybe affect some change. I think that everything that Larry said is 100% right on, and we'll see. I mean, it's the interests of corporations that they're getting their way, as opposed to a real democratic solution where instead of congressmen looking at, how many of my constituents care about this? It's, how influential is the one constituent? As an artist, I'm wanting to make art. I mean, here's a piece about the environment. The environment is something that I'm really worried about. The war, I'm still worried. I think we're wasting a lot of energy in Iraq. And, I don't know if the Russians couldn't do anything with Afghanistan. I mean, who knows? I feel like it's an interesting time for me as an artist because it's very easy to be opposed and to criticize, and now I'd like to help support some things. The green economy is really important to me. I think I have an image here that somewhere that, hey, see, that's what we've been doing wrong right here, the money, the
There you go. You have your
poster
great. Already.
Yeah. There actually is something somewhere that has to do with the environment. wait. All right. There we go. Yeah. Operation Oil Freedom. That's what Iraqi freedom's about, right? This image is called Evolve Devolve, and you know, it's we've had a great solution at our fingertips for years in wind, and you know, I'm trying to make art that, you know, I think this image is it's a little bit more classical than a lot of my stuff. It's great. I'm like, hey, I get to do a landscape. Isn't this awesome? You know, the fact that not all the aspects of the landscape are perfect, you know, is it keeps with tradition. But for me. But you know, I think global warming and what's going on with the Earth. I actually think that the whole, you know, war on terror is such a minuscule issue compared to it. It's such a tool of distraction to just keep the oil industry from really having to be called on the carpet. That's my opinion.
All right, let's open it up. Now we wanted to start things actually since we do have Andrew Philippone here of the brilliant Charlie Rose video we saw at the beginning. We thought we just would hear a word or two from Andrew and actually start by asking a question of the audience to you, Andrew. I'm fascinated by it. I'm curious your thoughts about this as well, Shepard. I'm fascinated by the process of this kind of art. So exactly how many hours of Charlie Rose did you watch? To create, like, how do you put something like this together just to figure out the components for it?
You know, I gave myself a real strict limit. I was going to record one episode, whatever it would be, on a certain night, and I did that. I actually fell asleep while I was recording. I had it rolling. Woke up around 12:30. It was over. I took the tape out, and the next day I started it. It only took about 8 hours of editing, actually, to make that. And it started by breaking the show down and finding some pattern in it somewhere. And the pattern was that Microsoft Yahoo exchange. And I started editing there and built out from either direction, front and back. And when it took that turn, that don't do that line, when it took that turn into like this dark kind of threatening thing, that's when the Beckett kind of thing sort of came about. It looked like a Beckett play. It sounded like a Beckett play, elliptical, absurd, almost pointless. And that was really it. So it really was, there's a lot of serendipity involved. It just kind of fell together. I wish there were more to it. It really, I wish everything were that easy. I mean, really, 8 hours total and it was done.
Is that how it works for you? Is it just incredibly easy when you're doing this thing?
lucky.
That's, you know, I'm stimulated by images. So a lot of times I collect tons of books and old magazines and newspapers, and you know, sometimes I get an image and I say, and I don't know what I'm going to use this for, but I'm going to put it in a folder and I'm going to go back to it. And then another image I find says, that's what's going to dovetail with the other one. So, for example, this image is based on a photograph I took looking from Williamsburg into Manhattan that was just a photo looking over the river, and you could see the skyline and some smokestacks. And then I was looking through an old Life magazine, and there was an ad with a couple looking at their track, the track home expanse, and saying, "Honey, we need to live here." And then I said, "All right, now I know what I'm doing. It's going to be there, looking across the river, and I'm going to create that these sunsets are to die for." So, the idea of, you know, the style of the '50s image, having this sort of naive optimism, a la Norman Rockwell, with the with sort of both the beauty, but also the fact that this is somewhat sinister, that the beautiful sunset is being created by pollution. That was how I was going to remix these elements. And sometimes these things come together very quickly. I did the Obama illustration in one evening and had it in production the next day. Time was of the essence. It was only a couple weeks till Super Tuesday. This, I had a couple of the images sitting around, one for years and one for at least a couple months before I realized that's what I'm going to do.
Great. Thanks. All right, now we had, as Paul mentioned on the blog, that apparently they've added at the New York Public Library here, which is very exciting. People have been emailing questions, and the first question actually that came in is from Paul Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky. Those are the kind of people hanging out on the NYPL blog already, only a couple days old. It's going to be a happening scene. And so this is for Shepard Fairey and Lawrence Lessig. Question, do you think technology has democratized the creative process and made it more of a social process? Can people ever be original again, or will everything be about sampling, graphic design material, video material, and sound?
As an artist, my opinion is, you know, once people are having to be original by throwing paint in front of a jet turbine to, like, spray on a canvas that's 50 feet away, it's like, let's just not be original. You know, I think one of my favorite Orwell quotes is, it is the duty of intelligent men, and I would add in parentheses, and women, to continuously restate the obvious. And the idea there, I think, being that that we're all so daft that the obvious isn't as obvious as it should be. These kinds of communications, to me, we say the same thing over and over and over in subtly new ways. I don't think I've ever had an original thought or original idea ever in my life. And there are a lot of people that have made me aware of that on the internet. However, I'm using that very tool to come up with art that I'm charging zillions of dollars for. So, I think that there can be creativity even within elements of recycling, and I absolutely think that it has democratized this process in a way that's incredibly powerful for people who were frequently powerless before, and I couldn't be happier about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we don't understand what the word original means, right? I mean, the word original doesn't mean you sort of are in the middle of a field creating something nobody has ever thought of before. I mean, if you think, for example, classical music was original, well, of course, classical music is a form. And when they made classical music, they took popular songs from the time and they incorporated it into that form. That was original composition at the time. You couldn't do that today, of course, because if you took, you know, Britney Spears and you incorporated it into some classical song, you would find lawyers at your door in a nanosecond, right? So you can't even be original in the way that they were original then. But the point is, what is original is relative to a genre of creativity. And what I find so striking about remix is how hard it is, not how easy it is. You want to do it well. You want to do it in a way that wants to make people listen to it 100 times or watch it 100 times so they can work out all the relationships and what exactly the references are about. You're teaching cultural literacy. You've got to respect the past in order to understand what great remixes are, as opposed to somebody who sits down and just writes a love ballad, right? That's original? Like, so again, you said it much better than I. Don't give me original if it's another Britney Spears song, right? Give me original in the sense of somebody who teaches us how the songs of the 90s, the Grey Album teaches us the relationship between the songs of the 60s and the songs of the 90s. Like, what is the relationship? How does it speak to us today? And that's an original expression, even if it is taking other stuff and mixing it in.
Who will walk up to this microphone here? Just walk on up. Just walk up to the microphone. Wrestle your way up to the front. There we go.
Hi there. My name is Tim Wu, and I have a question. It's really for anyone. Why is everyone laughing so hard? Anyway, you know, the thing that really fascinates me about the Associated Press lawsuit is exactly what you were talking about, is this decision. Is that they even decided to bring this lawsuit at all. And what's interesting is that, Shepard, you're in the same position that they're in. In other words, you're both entities where people are using or remixing your work, yet your decision process was so different than their decision process. And one of the problems of the system is that the human element has been lost. It's not actually a human, I mean, it's sort of functionally a human deciding things at AP, but Associated Press is not a human being. Associated Press is an organization. And they're making their decisions only, you know, in this completely robotic way, where they're thinking, well, there's a possibility of making more money off this. So at some essence, part of the problem here is that the decisions being made are just being made in this sort of insane way.
Well, I think that you know, people should be behaving as, you know, ethical human beings first, you know, with a sensitivity to all the different variables, all the different dynamics, you know, with revenue being maybe just one small facet of it. What I love is when people go, oh, well, this one company, they used to be really, really for the people, and then they went public, and now they've got the shareholders to answer to. As if, you know, if they don't make enough profits, the shareholders will be waiting outside the office with pitchforks, and, well, maybe they will be, but I don't know. But, you know, I feel like, you know, I make art not just about making money, so that's not what my primary focus is. The AP, you know, I was surprised by their response, considering that when there was speculation on the internet that it was a Reuters photo, and in fact a lot of people were convinced it was a Reuters photo. Both Reuters itself, as an organization that that functions similarly to the AP, and the Reuters photographer said that they were proud and honored that the image was derived from their property. It's a really big difference. Right. Wouldn't it have been great if it really was the Reuters photo?
Next
for
time,
me?
It's a Reuters photo.
But I wouldn't be here with these awesome guys. Anyway, you know, and Obama's president, so I mean, come on. What is there to be bummed about? But yeah, you know, maybe he knows about the influence and corruption and stuff.
Yeah, I would just add, it's a pathetic defense to say it's the institution. There is no such thing as an institution. There are people sitting inside an institution who make a decision, and they should be responsible for the decision. It's an outrageous decision to invoke this federal regulation against a creator like this, or to threaten to invoke it, just like it was outrageous to try to take Holden Lentz down from YouTube because barely in the background there's this music by the artist now known but formerly known, or formerly now known as formerly known as Prince in the being playing. I mean, that's a decision by a human being who should be held accountable for his very bad judgment in imbalance.
Thank you, first of all. One of the things that I heard that really amazed me, and I have a question about this. So you said something about this form of literacy, what you guys are doing. And what I didn't hear addressed, and where remixing really was, you know, in inner cities and our educational, you know, education is an absolute mess. And we have kids inside of inner cities that have kind of pioneered this, that are killing each other. And I want to know, where does artists, do you guys and attorneys share, and everybody here shares a responsibility? You know, you talk about the policies on top and green and war, but the wars that are going on inside of our schools, and where, and these are the kids that are really remixing. What, I didn't hear anything at all in this conversation that, you know, we have a black president and we have three white educated men, and I know I just did a study in a Johnny Cochran school in South LA, that 13-year-olds are spending 4 to 6 hours a day on YouTube and MySpace, mashing things up. So my question is, where's the responsibility of artists and the system?
Well, let me start with the system. So in the last book I did, Free Culture, I tell a story of Elizabeth Daly and Stephanie Barish, who are in L.A., were launching these programs inside of L.A. schools to encourage kids to do mashup, remix movies. And what they found was, you know, whereas you couldn't get kids to focus for 30 minutes in the English class trying to learn to write an essay, these kids were spending 12 hours a day at school learning how to make film and remix film and to make music videos and to express in this form creativity. And what's so outrageous about the current system, of course, is that the technology invites these kids to be creative in a way that the technology of 50 years ago didn't, right? It took a lot of training to be a great guitarist. It takes less training to be a great user of the technology of today. But the law says when they create this fantastic remix, the school is not allowed to put it up on the internet. Because if they put it up on the internet, the lawyers in the school will say, oh, I'm sorry, the legal liability here is too great. So the kids create, they can't even show it to their friends. The school forbids them from even having an exhibit in the school that shows it because of what the law says. So my view is, this is literacy in the 21st century. We have to validate it because it is a literacy that's not just fantastic for rich, well-educated kids. It's also fantastic in the most democratic way for the widest range of any kid that can get access to a computer. And that's as much a reason to be fighting for it as anything that has to do with what rich kids would think.
Just to add to that, the only time I ever did well in school was when I would get extra credit for having a visual aid for a presentation. And that was because the only reason I did the research on the topic was so that I could make a good visual aid, so that whatever communication was in my poster actually had some foundation in research I'd had to do to write the paper. So, you know, the idea of creativity enhancing learning, I think that value is immeasurable.
Let me go back to the online questions. This is actually from Angela Stach, who I think may be here. The question is, since this event takes place in a physical library with millions of tangible book objects, also known as books. yeah, I'm sorry, Angela, I don't mean to make fun of your excellence. I think it's a great question, that's why I'm asking it. Is there a future for the book, and if so, what future may it be?
Yes.
Good. Well, actually, let me say something about it. I think that I've noticed, and I think we're going to see more and more of this because of things like the Kindle, which I just got the other day, the ebook from Amazon, is I have this process in writing books now that I've kind of built over the years, which is that when I'm doing research for a book, I assemble this mass of quotations, basically, from everything I've read online, everything I've kind of outlined in books that I've dutifully transcribed over and copied over. And when I sit down to actually write a chapter, what I do is I grab all the quotes that I think might be useful for that document, throw them into the same, you know, kind of Word file, and launch that, and I start writing the chapter with these kinds of islands of quotations from other sources.
You copied that for me.
Really?
Yes.
I think I told you about it first. And what it does is, I mean, eventually, sometimes you eliminate the quotes over time, you rewrite them, you come up with your own words, sometimes you use them, but you start with this kind of archipelago of ideas that are there, and it helps you with that kind of initial writer's block of looking at a blank page. You've got all these ideas. And I think that is actually how writers really have always worked. We've just had tools that have made it easier for us to do that. And the more text we have that is digital and that we can move around and kind of build these, you know, kind of little islands of connection, I think in the long run we're going to be better off.
Absolutely. So the follow-up from yes was, and therefore all of these books need to be digital. They have to be accessible digitally, freely accessible digitally if it's out of copyright or even it's out of print. But books are actually a hopeful medium because we can actually digitize books once they go out of copyright and make them accessible. If you contrast that with, for example, documentary film, it's a total nightmare. Documentary film in the 20th century was made with this practice. You would make a film, you would take 60 seconds from CBS, you would sign a license with CBS that says, you agree your only right to the 60 seconds from CBS is governed by this license, and you agree that you only have permission to distribute this for 5 years in North America for educational purposes. Which means at the end of 5 years, the only way you can release the film is to go clear the rights to all of these bits that have been put into the film. Now, what that means is, this whole generation of creativity, 95% of it will be illegal to distribute, not because of copyright, but because of these licenses. There's an extraordinary documentary in Charles Guggenheim, whose daughter, Grace Guggenheim, has literally spent 20 years of her life clearing the rights to her father's films so that she can put them on DVDs. Now, this is a complete disaster for this culture, unlike books. We will always have access to books, but not access to films. But if you go to Washington and you say, this is the problem of copyright, this is the thing we need to be worrying about, as well as worrying about the RIAA, they don't even understand that there's a problem. They don't even know that there's an issue here to think about.
All right, we have one time for one more question. Let's do it in the room. You, sir.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Werner. I have a question for Professor Lessig. Actually, two, but they're related. At the beginning of the Change Congress movement, there was a suggestion that you might run for office in Congress, but at the time you decided not to. Are you going to change that? Are you going to run for office?
So I have promised my firstborn male child, if I break the promise, that I'm never running for Congress, because I became convinced the only way to convince people that you're actually serious about reform is to commit irrevocably to not become part of the system that you think is broken. I think if I had been, I wouldn't have been elected. We have a fantastic Congresswoman, Jackie Speier. I think she's amazing. I shouldn't have beat her. So I think, you know, there's no reason I should have won. But if I had been elected, I could not begin to bring about the kind of change that I think has to happen and be a member of Congress. Members of Congress spend 40 to 70% of their time on the phone raising money to go back to Congress. I mean, this is outrageous. Half their time, at least, is spent not dealing with the national problems we have, but just trying to raise money to get back to Congress. And I would have been part of that system. So I think that what we need is people, citizen reformers, who want to change the system from the outside. And that's my commitment in what Change Congress is trying to do.
The second half of the related question then, if there is a spot within your next 10 years of this topic, if there is a spot becoming on the Supreme Court, will you seek to fill it?
No.
Will you run for president? How
about
that?
Yes, no, I am running for president,
of course.
No, we didn't
bring that up.
Well, I think it's time to drink Brooklyn beer. And it's time also to tell you that you can submit questions that Talent will answer in a little while. There's a table there. Join the library. And Lawrence Lessig, Stephen Johnson, Shepard Fairey, thank you very much.